Well, good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see you on such a beautiful Sabbath day. Hope everybody's doing well. Last Friday, a group of five of us ascended the slope of Mount Rainier to near the base camp. In the party, it was included Dr. Wayne Topping of the Teacher Roy congregation, our own Aaron King. We also had James Rowan, who was sitting next to my wife, a visitor from the Cincinnati North congregation, as well as my wife and I. And after a much-needed rest on the Sabbath, we did successfully ascend to the summit top Sunday morning. Now, this afternoon, I'd like to tell you a little about the trip, about spending time on this magnificent mountain that God has created, and what we can learn about climbing as it relates to our relationship with Him, with one another, and as a congregation. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit about climbing and a little about the trip. Typically, mountains of this size are ascended in two stages. The first stage is where you go to what is called high camp or base camp. This is where you get your packs all laden with your tents, your sleeping bags, your mountaineering gear, food, water, and everything like that. And in this particular case, we started from Paradise Ranger Station, which is about 5,400 feet elevation, and then we proceeded through all the different snowfields and flats up to Camp Muir, which is about 10,100 feet out. And this became then our home for the next 2 days. The second phase of the climb is the actual ascending to the summit. This is where you're actually packing with lighter gear. You're not taking your tents with you and this sort of thing. But you do need to get up about midnight, so it would excite all of you. Which is, you can call it Saturday night, call it Sunday morning, call it what you will. And the reason you get up so early in the morning to ascend the mountain is because that's when the snow is firmest and the ice is firmest. This is the safest time to ascend. And so if you can just imagine trying to get, you know, five people out of their sleeping bags, you know, the moaning and the groaning that goes on getting somebody up at midnight. You get out and you get your clothes on and you don yourself with a helmet with a headlamp. It's obviously midnight, you want to be able to see. You then put a harness around your midsection, and your harness is actually tied to all the other people on your rope team. And actually what you have is about a 30-foot distance between each and the rest of the people on the rope. So you've got five people all up on a rope team. Also around your midsection on this, on your harness is these ropes called prefix. Now what prefix are used, you hope you don't have to use them, but what they're intended to use is that if you ever fell in a crevasse or a hole, and you actually had to make your own way up the rope, prefix are used that allow you to actually shimmy your way right up the rope. So you have those, in fact, before you go. And on top of that, of course, then when you look down at your feet, you have mountain boots, and on them you have what is called crampons. And what crampons are these big steel apparatus things that you strap to the bottom of your boots, because this allows you to have traction on snow and ice. And so one of the things you do, also, before you start ascending up, is you do a buddy check. You make sure that the people in front of you and behind you, that they're all roped in properly, that they have all their equipment strapped on properly, because when you proceed up in the rope, obviously what will happen to one person could indeed happen to all, because you're sort of joined together. So this is where we started, at about 1:15, maybe 1:30 in the morning, after we chanced to try to wash down a little food and a little tea, we started our ascent. Now, Camp Muir, as I mentioned, is about 10,100 feet up. From there, we actually traverse the top of a snowfield, which is the upper part of what's called Cowlitz Glacier. So right there's a sort of a bowl-shaped thing that we traverse across, then we go over a rock ledge, which is called Cathedral Rocks. And then once on the other side of that, you ascend slowly up the mountain on the other side of these rocks to a place called Ingraham Flats, and that's about 11,000 feet up. That's at the top of what is called Ingraham Glacier. So you're still mostly on glacier and glacier snow all through this part. The next part is the most interesting, I'd say. It's called Disappointment Cleaver. I tell you, when you're at the top of Ingraham Flats and you're looking up, you get to see other, in this case, we got to see other people on ropes actually ascending the cleaver, and they're all wearing their headlights. So if you look, headlamps, so you're all looking up there, and you see these little, kind of look like little centipedes with lights, making their way up the mountain. And the cleaver is a very steep part of the climb. And they call it Disappointment Cleaver for a reason. It's quite apropos. But there you're ascending 1,400 feet mostly on the ridge with rock. So you're actually on either side of you is glacier. Actually on one side there's a lot of crevasse activity. On the other side there's a big glacial snowfield, which ends in a crevasse. So you really got to pay attention as you're making your way up there. But then at the top, you're at 12,400 feet at Disappointment Quaver, and that's where you reach a small plateau. And then from there, there is a series of snowfields that take you the extra 2,000 feet as you get to the actual summit crater at 14,410 feet. So it was a beautiful climb. We had, actually by the time we got to the snowfields area, we had winds that ranged from 30 to 50 miles an hour. So that was a bit of a challenge as snow and ice were to blow off the mountain into your face. That can be a bit intimidating, but it did clear, and you could see 150 miles in any direction from the top of that mountain. And it was just incredible to behold. So what does climbing have to do with our relationship with God? What does it have to do with each other or as a congregation? Well, so much of what happened on the climb had a parallel with our walk with God that I wanted to share some of those insights with you, some of the lessons, as we refer to them, lessons of the mountain. I have four to share with you. The first is that there is a unity of purpose on the mountain. I mean, when you're up at base camp at Camp Muir, you don't need to run around to the other camps and ask people what they're doing there. Everybody knows what they're doing there. They all know where they're going. They all know what they're doing. They're all there to climb. Everybody is there to climb. And you know, what is our purpose here today? What are we doing here? And we have a unity of purpose, do we not? We're here to worship God. We're here to draw closer to Him. We want to enter His kingdom. We want to be like Him. And if you read in Matthew 6:33, we're to seek first the kingdom of God. We do have a unity of purpose here, a very clear unity of purpose. The second lesson on the mountain was that you can get tired. You can get disappointed, and you can really feel burdened on the mountain. As I mentioned earlier, at the beginning of the climb going up to base camp, this is when we have our heaviest packs. Most of us carry packs 50 pounds of weight. And you can feel burdened just from the outset. I mean, I don't know if any of you have been to Paradise, the intersection of the parking lot there, and if you look up at the mountain's a very ominous thing, and it rises 9,000 feet above the parking lot, and then it's right there in front of your face. It can be rather intimidating. And your burden can feel very heavy right from the very start. And you know, your sense of the burden doesn't necessarily change in the course of the climb either. You know, I mentioned that we emerge from our sleeping bags at midnight. And it's hard to temper the thought that, hey, you know, that tent is right over there, that sleeping bag is warm. You know, you think about how tired you are. After all, you're getting up at midnight. It had been blowing on the mountain considerably, so most of us didn't get any sleep, or very little at that, not only from the wind, but because everybody's excited on the mountain, everybody in the tent seemed to chatter and make a lot of noise in the night. And so you're tired, and you question the validity of why you are there. You ask yourself, what on earth am I doing here? And this also occurred, especially when we were going up Disappointment Cleaver. And when you look at the rock face, you look at the dangers around you, you feel how tired you are. It is hard not to entertain the thought. And do we not here sometimes become weary? Do you ever feel tired? Do you ever kind of lack some motivation maybe? Maybe motivation to pursue God? I was thinking this morning about some of the promises I made to myself that, you know what, you know, I'm going to get up early, I'm going to study, I'm going to do all these things, and I can almost invariably remember that when the alarm clock went off, that, oh, man, you know, God wants me to get rest, too. Does he? I don't really need to get up right now. But you can feel that way. You can feel tired. You can sometimes lack motivation. But we do get help, don't we? Christ promised us in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, I'll read through it quickly here, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. And these words we thought about, too, when we were going up the mountain, as we got progressively more tired the farther up we went. Another thing that can happen on the mountain, point three, is you can get frustrated. You can easily get frustrated on the mountain, especially when you feel others are impeding your progress. Now, there were several teams on the mountain. There's probably, we're guessing, somewhere between 60 and 70 people on the mountain when we were there, 100 during the course of the day. And oftentimes, our ascent was halted by other people going slower, taking more time. Some of them were with rope teams that were with guides, and they all had to stick together, and it was a lot slower. And sometimes you can get really frustrated going up because with the winds blowing and everything else going on, you get cold, your fingers cramp up, you ache, and you really want to keep moving so you can stay warm, and so you can get frustrated. And it's easy, again, to look at those people as obstacles, like they're in your way, when you really should be looking at them as compatriots. And it did dawn on all of us that, after all, would it not be the greatest shame to ascend to the top at the expense of someone else not making it? It really would be a shame. So you start turning, you start helping people, and you start thinking differently. And the relationships in our life can create similar frustrations. You know, there may be times we don't get along perfectly. Maybe you have made great headway in something in your life. Maybe you have overcome something. You have made great progress. You feel very comfortable in it. And then something comes along, a trial. Or maybe someone thwarts it, challenges it, creates a barrier to moving forward more on it. And that can create frustration for you. And these things happen. But God does require that we have love, patience, and understanding with all people, that we actually go so far as to bear one another's burdens. I mean, do we not all want everyone to get to the top? I think we do. I think we do. You know, in 1 John 3:11, we're reminded that, for this is the message that you've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. You know, when you're on the mountain, you have a sense about the continuity of God. When the mountain's very, you think back, well, at least I thought back about the conversation with Job back in Job, I think it was 38 verse 4, where God says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" You know, you're very sure about God's promises, and they're as sure as the earth upon which you walk, the creation around us. You can see Him in all that, that His promises are true. Comforting in knowing that the rules don't change. The fourth point is that you can easily lose your footing on the mountain. And you're constantly reminded of the importance of where you're going and where you place your feet. And because you're all roped together with your team, every step you take has a bearing on the welfare of the group. And there are times, like I said, when we had wind gusts of 40 to 50 miles an hour, losing your footing could potentially drag your entire team down the mountain. And we do have an accountability one to another. We really do. And as Christians, we must always be on our guard. When we're most likely to fall, we are most confident of our own strength. Our best security is total dependence, total and absolute dependence on God. Of course, we're reminded in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, that therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Keeping your footing secure is also a reminder of the importance of being faithful in the little things. We must keep the big goal in sight, but not forget the small things, every small step that carries us there. And on the mountain, that was very, very true, especially the last 2,000 feet. Very rarely could we actually stand up straight, because if we did, we'd get blown off the mountain. And so you're constantly looking for each little step, making sure each one's secure, and you're looking for everybody else as well far on the mountain, too. Because obviously, if a rope team above you fell, they could fall and take you too. So climbing is an exercise in perspective. The closer to the top you get, as oxygen and physical energy wane, the weaker and more vulnerable you are. Our relationship with God works the same way. The closer we get to Him, the more we understand how small we are and how much we rely upon Him for everything, and that we can accomplish nothing without Him. As we conclude, I'd like you to turn to Micah chapter 4. I'm going to read verses 1 through 3. Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, "Come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us His ways, and we shall walk in His paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. We're reminded of the promise of the coming kingdom of God, of where we all want to go, where we all want to ascend to. Now, climbing reminds us that we can have confidence in our unity of purpose, in our faith that we will be led and our burdens will be eased. And let us look out one for another. Help each other up the mountain. Take steps that enhance the welfare of each other. Let it serve as a reminder that with God's help and direction, we can have a faithful footing. And let us all go up to the mountain of the Lord.